Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So I wanted to start out with kind of a public service health and safety reminder. Recently, I wrote a letter to the editor of Outlook Santa Cruz, which is sort of coming to serve as our local newspaper for news and, to a certain extent, what's going on in the county. And there was an article by Max Chun about, he called it Carmageddon, but he was mentioned that there had been a 34% increase in bicycle use, and this was related to errands and other activities. And I first of all wanted to praise the city of Santa Cruz for attempting to increase the number of bike riders, because I applaud those well-marked bike lanes and the other safety measures that have been taken. I also think that 34% of increased bike riders presents also a safety issue. As we move to a society that does not immediately gravitate towards getting a driver's license in one's teens, I think we may be also moving towards a society with an excessively freewheeling attitude about road safety. My colleagues in the emergency room tell me that bicycle accidents have increased substantially in the last few years. Now, we don't have a good denominator, so we don't, obviously the 34% increase amounts to a denominator. More bicycles out there means more accidents. But also, I've seen since e-bikes became so commonplace in the last 3 to 4 years, I've seen more problematic behavior, particularly at stop signs and intersections. And it has me worried. I've also seen a lot of the helmet laws not being obeyed. And these are helmet laws that are mandatory for people under 18. And as far as that goes, over 18, you still want your brain. I suggest to you, as parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, younger listeners with friend groups, social media influencers, to address these issues. Please, we've got to get law enforcement and the school officials to work with education and enforcement of the existing rules, which are perfectly fine if people would just enforce and follow them. One way to do that without handing out tickets, which probably isn't a good strategy, is simply outreach and education. Perhaps providing an anonymized data on serious bicycle injuries in our community. If you don't give the location and you don't give the name, I think that still qualifies as suitably anonymous. But it would serve as a kind of, this could happen to you. 14-year-old suffers 2 broken legs in collision with van. I've talked about this before in the show. But this time, I'm not addressing the bicycle riders. I'm addressing the drivers of all vehicles. We need to exercise vigilance and caution. We need to remain alert with our eyes and ears open. Listening to headphones while driving anything faster than your legs is probably a really bad idea, because you can't hear what's going on around you, and it encases you in a sort of bubble. We have all a social responsibility to stay out of each other's way and make sure that we're alert in case someone gets inadvertently in our way, that we don't have a serious accident. So that's all I have on that. But just think about who you can influence, and please act to influence them. Our next story is about scientific oops, but it's actually good news about microplastics. And so we don't get too much good news about microplastics. So let me set this up. with a little story about the researcher who found this. This is a researcher named Dr. Clough, C-L-O-U-G-H, and she was looking, she was doing environmental studies, and in her environmental studies, they were looking at air content for microplastics, and there, the study was done at, the University of Michigan, and they were looking at Michigan's atmosphere. The lead investigator, the faculty member was Dr. Anne McNeil, and they were using some graduate students and doing simple chemistry. They were using air samples, and they put them with a metal substrate. The air passes through the sampler, and the particles deposit, kind of like fly power paper, onto the substrate. And then using light-based spectroscopy, the researchers were able to determine what kind of particles are found on the substrate. Now, Clough prepared the substrates while wearing vinyl gloves, but when she examined the substrates to estimate how many microplastics she'd captured, the results were many thousand of times greater than what we would expect. Remember, this is atmospheric plastic, and it led to such a high number that they knew it was contaminated. Everyone knew that the number was too high to be correct. They investigated everything in the lab. Was it the plastic squirt bottle? Was it particles in the atmosphere in the lab? Was someone sanding plastics with a Dremel tool in the next room and the air got in? It turned out that the problem was actually the gloves, the blue nitrile gloves. But it turns out to be not just a problem for nitrile, but also latex gloves. They tested about seven different types of gloves, and the only ones that didn't have a major shedding like white Angora kitty on a black velvet couch problem were the clean room gloves. On the average, the gloves imparted about 2,000 false positives per millimeter square area. Now, this throws into doubt years of research in hundreds of labs. We may have been, for example, when they tell you they found this many microplastics in lung tissue, they were extrapolating from a slide running it through this same spectroscopy process, and they were counting at least how by what percentage, we can't say, glove lint as microplastic. Now, what's going on here? Well, the researchers designed another experiment to determine what was going on. And what was going on turned out to be that, or the clue, I should say, was that clean room gloves didn't do it. So look at the manufacturer. What is the difference between the clean room gloves and the other gloves? And the answer is that when you're making regular plastic, vinyl, nitrile, latex, etc. gloves, you use a mold and you dip that mold in polymer and then let it dry and you have your glove. But just as I, as a sculptor using a mold, might use a talcum powder or cornstarch or even dry powdered clay, although that's a little risky, as my release, so that it pops out of the mold cleanly, they use a compound called stearate. And using the electron microscopy as well as light-based microscopy, stearate is virtually impossible to distinguish from polyethylene. The particles look just alike. And, of course, on the spectroscopy, they do as well because they're chemically similar. We assumed, because they keep germs out, that they were keeping our hands from contaminating the samples. Now we see that maybe much of this research overestimated, and we won't know until we literally revise the techniques and redo the research using clean room gloves. And I just thought that was a really, really good example about why science matters and why ongoing science matters, because this looked like perfectly good research until someone found this problem. BPA was something that we thought that those particular plastic bottles that were used in labs were very clean. In fact, people were deliberately using them to drink out of because, hey, they don't contaminate, they don't hold on to chemicals, they release the chemicals, except they also release the BPA into the water and off onto our hands from the little shiny receipts that we get when we purchase anything. I mean, once you put this stuff into the environment, it finds its way all over the place. And in the case of the gloves, I find it just a really good object lesson of why we need to keep doing research and why we need to keep thinking and not make assumptions and realize that we may be based on a false premise, like these gloves are preventing contamination. And we always have to be prepared to back out and shift our viewpoint when the premise that it was operating under turns out to be false. I wish we could get that to happen with politics, but that's a little harder. So let's talk about skin. Dermatologists for years have been putting out just nice, gentle soap and moisturize. But if you go online and follow social media, you'll see hundreds of products and hundreds of skin treatments being promoted. Turns out that skin is just as sophisticated. It's not just a barrier or a brick wall. It's almost a television screen telling us about your health, as well as a gateway for the entry and exit of materials. It's a very, very dynamic organ. There are three layers, as you probably know, the hypodermis or subcutaneous tissue, the dermis, the middle, and the epidermis, the top. And the epidermis constantly churns out fresh skin cells. We lose about 40,000 dead skin cells a day. And the chief component of that house dust that you vacuum up and dust off, well, it's you. It's residual you and your family layering out, first of all, volatilizing, or if it's simply getting brushed off, it's so small that they remain airborne. They settle down eventually somewhere. And over a while, over time, you get quite the layer. Now, that outmost area, the stratum cornea, those are flat, dead cells. They are filled with protein called keratin. And they're like shingles on a roof. They are there to, they're locked down by a type of fat called a ceramide. And those essentially help create a moisture barrier, a little bit like tar. Maybe if you had tar paper and shingles up there, they keep invaders out. And the skin barrier is incredibly dynamic. Common signs of compromised skin barrier include persistent dryness, itchiness and redness, and also acne and recurrent infections. And, of course, if you have these, you're more likely to go on to develop diagnosable skin conditions like atopic dermatitis, psoriasis, and even allergies. And, of course, your skin is less good at keeping out bacteria, so you're more likely to have infections. What you don't want to do, and probably what is the most common mistake, is stripping your skin, getting rid of those ceramides and other lipids. So astringents, alcohol, witch hazel, those are great for removing makeup and bacteria, but they also strip away the natural oils. That barrier that we're talking about is made of a thin layer of oils, fatty acids, and amino acids, and it creates the conditions for a healthy and protective microbiome to flourish. Wiping out lipids with harsh particles also raises pH levels. The normal skin has a nice acidic pH, which also helps discourage the growth of the bad bacteria and encourage the growth of the protective good bacteria. more ecosystem stuff. Another way to get into trouble is hot showers. And of course, I'm a great fan of hot tubs, and that's something that, you know, has some chemicals in it. So I'm always showering off in cool water to get rid of the bromine that is in my sterilizer, and also hydrating, putting some nice neutral oil like a unscented sesame oil on my skin afterwards to restore that barrier. What the American Academy of Derm says, wash your face twice a day with a gentle cleanser, put on moisturizer, and if it's daytime, put on sunscreen and wear a hat. I won't go into UV. I think that ultraviolet and the damage that it causes is pretty well known. What might not be known is that both UVA and UVB disrupt a protein in the skin that acts as a kind of Velcro and keeps those skin cells sticking together. This is a deeper layer than the squamous layer on the top, but it's very important for preventing chemicals and other compounds to get into your skin. Now, of course, we know that sunscreen is good. It reduces the risk of developing melanoma. But one of the problems that I've seen with social media is there's this thread that sunscreens cause skin cancer and vitamin D deficiency. As far as vitamin D deficiency is concerned, they may have a point if you are dipping your entire body in it and live in a cave. But I think the causing skin cancer is, well, you can't prove negative, but there is plenty of evidence to the contrary. The main thing to worry about, it really, is whether or not the sunscreen that you use actually has what they say they have in it. Moisturizers are also important. Usually they will include a emollient, some kind of oil, that fills in the gaps between the skin cells and the lipids, sort of making it a tighter seal. Humectants, like hyaluronic acid, pull moisture from the outside air and bring that to the surface, so they're moisturizing. And occlusives, things like petroleum jelly, prevent water loss but can clog pores. Other compounds that are healthy to use on your skin are vitamins. Vitamin A is often used to treat acne, psoriasis, and aging. It works by increasing cell turnover and collagen production. It also reduces wrinkles and dark spots. Vitamin C and other antioxidants are very helpful, and when applied topically, they help prevent collagen and elastin from being damaged by air pollution. So that's another reason to protect your skin. I've certainly had an experience with using a high-strength vitamin C on my face after a strong sun exposure, or particularly a wind exposure while skiing, where I would expect to be chapped and kind of red the next day. And the vitamin C used before and then after seems to really act as a very strong protective agent in that case. The skin is also a good place for diagnoses. It tells a doctor looking at you whether you're eating a nutrient-rich diet with plenty of antioxidants. You can see when a person is nutrient deficient by changes in their skin. Many types of poisoning also show up as changes in the skin and the nails. And some studies have found that if you mess with the microbiome, you change inflammatory signals in the skin. So there's a link between gastrointestinal health and skin disorders. And that's where the diet and functional medicine approach to psoriasis comes in. Another thing that has been looked at in mice, aging skin expresses more inflammatory cytokines than young skin. So skin could be partly responsible for the background increases in these inflammatory cytokines in the blood that shows up. One small 2019 study showed that treating older people's skin with an emollient actually reduced the levels of cytokines circulating in the blood, suggesting that this might prevent some or reduce the inevitable increase in inflammation that comes with aging. We know that longevity, and particularly healthy longevity, are very closely linked with inflammation and the ability not to become too inflamed. When we look at the genetics of people who live into their second century, their people who are over 100, in other words, one of the things we find is a remarkable amount of genes that are anti-inflammatory and help that in sort of inevitable inflammation be less inevitable. Let's talk about music. Making music is a mental workout. The brain must simultaneously coordinate sound and vision, as well as fine motor control, focus, and imagination. This bounces stuff all over the brain, just the way that a good basketball game will throw you all over that basketball court. Over time, this stretches the brain like a muscle. Several studies have found that professional musicians have more gray matter in some regions of their brains than non-musicians. It's hard to find conclusive evidence, but here's a study from 2020 that suggests that musicians may also have better executive function. That is to say, the part of the brain in the front that helps with planning and problem solving and anticipating consequences and staying out of trouble. A meta-analysis from 2017 concluded that musicians also have a sharper memory, and a study from last year suggested they may even be less sensitive to pain. In this experiment, 40 participants were injected in the hand with a compound that mimics muscle soreness. They found that subjects with musical experience reported less pain. A paper from 2010 found that musicians who began training before the age of 7 have a larger corpus callosum, the neural bridge between the brain's two hemispheres, than later starters. And a study from 2014 suggested that learning an instrument also improves children's second language acquisition and nonverbal reasoning. And when I read that one, I thought about the Baroque period in Europe, when everybody spoke German and Italian and French and English, and they moved around all over the place playing music and going to concerts. And this wasn't just the upper class. This was the middle class, that anybody basically who could afford a theater ticket probably spoke two or three languages. And most people also played one or two instruments. So I wonder if there's not historical evidence that if you use your brain in a musical way in childhood, you're going to have more language ability in adulthood. There are some studies in older adults showing that continuing to learn an instrument was associated with less deterioration. But the problem with studies like this is we don't know whether the people who kept playing for longer just were the ones who weren't going to get dementia as soon. And the, you know, you can't really figure out cause and effect on a study like that. An interesting study from 2024 looking at 1,000 older Britons found that pianists and brass players tended to have better working memory, woodwind players had superior executive functioning, singers excelled in verbal reasoning. However, those who played several instruments actually kind of zeroed out. They didn't have any additional extra neural benefit than those who played one instrument. When you play an instrument, it produces pleasure and reward, especially when you hit all of the notes. That sets off the endorphins, which, of course, relieve pain. And you're spending time when you're performing in a band or an orchestra or a choir, you're in flow. Your body is literally vibrating with exactly the same pattern of sound as the bodies of other people around you. And that is for what effectively we are, which is a herd animal. Or this is a really, literally resonant, both in terms of the physics, but it also in terms of the cognitive and emotional response. Regular listeners to music do better, and we don't have causality as far as this is concerned, but if you're over 70 and you regularly listen to music, like, for example, keep your radio tuned to KSQD and enjoy our wide variety of both musical and talk and discussion offerings, I'm basically ready to suggest that you may indeed be feeding your brain and making it stronger. Now, this is an interesting trope that is, I kind of doubted it initially, but I am now looking at the sort of predominance of the industry of the evidence and thinking, I think this is a strong one. And so advocacy for vaccination coming up, trigger warning to those who may have a trouble with this. But a growing body of work suggests that simply taking a course of the shingles vaccine can meaningfully slow the decline. New data suggests that it cuts dementia risk by as much as 20%. Now, we all know about shingles. It's basically a recurrence of the chickenpox virus, which many people, possibly certainly the majority in my age group, contracted as a child. Now, of course, that percentage in younger cohorts is less because we've had a varicella vaccine for a long time, and the varicella is the name of the virus that causes shingles. Varicella is a zoster virus. So it's, you've got herpes zoster and varicella zoster, and they're first cousins. They share a lot of traits, one of which is the blistering, painful rash that they call that they cause. The other is their ability to hibernate in nerve cells. And so those pesky little virions just go and hang out in your spinal column or in the ganglia at the base of your brain and wake up every now and then and try to reproduce and climb up to the skin via the nerves and pop open little bubbles and release themselves to the universe. In fact, when a person has shingles, I always take great cautions to warn them that that fluid that is leaking out is actually contagious. It contains active infectious virus, and you can infect a newborn. You can infect a person who is immunosuppressed. So it's very important to cover those lesions and wash your hands frequently and ideally avoid being around people who are still vulnerable to it. So Shingrix is the most common vaccine we use today. And it does not contain live virus. It contains particles, proteins, small amounts that were taken from the virus surface. And they are the sorts of things that in the bloodstream, the immune system would see on the surface of the virus. And so the immune system, being taught to attack these, will go after them in the tissue surrounding the nerves. So as the virus tries to break out, it's contained before it has a chance to get to the skin. Now, reactivation shingles can occur any time, but it's typically triggered by stress and age and also other viral infections. It's not unusual for people to get a bad flu and then end up 6 weeks, 3 to 6 weeks later with a case of the shingles. We have this dementia data for the reason that the vaccine is recent and was rolled out in each country a little bit differently because most of the countries pay for the vaccinations of their populace. It's in their interest to do so. And there are sharp age cutoffs. You are 50, you are less than 50. So the rollout in each country or region compared with and combined with a large number of people has set up this wonderful natural experiment, the fruits of which are now coming to light. In recent years, Pascal Geldseltzer, a researcher at Stanford, has used this technique to examine dementia prevalence data for populations in Australia, New Zealand, and Wales. in a paper published this February in Lancet Neurology. He and his colleagues also looked at almost 500,000 residents of the Canadian province of Ontario. The findings across all four regions point to the shingles vaccine reducing the number of people who develop either dementia or mild cognitive decline later in life. That's interesting. Another study published in the Journals of Gerontology suggests that this is not just related to dementia. Researchers also assigned something they call a healthy aging score to 3,800 adults above the age of 70, based on seven measures, including inflammation and accumulated changes to DNA. The researchers concluded that those who had previously received the vaccine had lower levels of inflammation as well as a better overall score. Now, how might we interpret that data? Well, here's a possibility. The immediate hypothesis that rises to my surface is that a case of shingles, especially when it's severe, will cause the person to behave differently for sometimes months or even years. Their activity is reduced during the active phase of the disease, but afterwards many people have nerve damage and continue to have a sort of smoldering battle going on in their nerves, and so the virus doesn't really quite stop being active. That's going to raise all kinds of cytokines and inflammatory markers. Many of these can cross the blood-brain barrier, get into the brain, and activate the microglia. And we know that inflammation in the immune system of the brain definitely leads to cognitive decline. Some of that, in fact, reversible. These studies, of course, being epidemiologic studies with an aging score being assigned at a point in time, have no ability to look at that reversibility. But I think it's probably there if we can turn that inflammation around. The idea that seemingly dormant chickenpox might not be entirely dormant, and that the vaccine actually slams the lid on the coffin, so to speak, or at least on the closet, and keeps it at a level that it is no longer provoking the inflammation. Now, I want to point out that data on herpes or simplex oral, which, you know, so-called fever blisters, and worsening dementia goes back to the 1990s. And in fact, there are papers published then in people who were suffering from Alzheimer's who would deteriorate while they had active herpes simplex and then improve a bit when that particular infection disappeared or went quiescent, more accurately, disappeared from view. And the inflammatory chemicals reduced. So some advice, because the Shingrix vaccine is a strong medicine, and I would strongly recommend not taking it at the same time as the flu vaccine. Not that the flu vaccine is bad or the Shingrix is bad, but I think unless you are very young and vigorous and very busy, it makes sense to just go to the pharmacy two or 3 weeks apart and get the shots in sequence rather than together. Some of that has to do with the irritants that are put in the body, which are pro-inflammatory. So if you take both vaccines, you're doubling the pro-inflammatory irritants. And you should give your body time to respond and set and reset the registers, so to speak, calm down and turn everything off and ready for the next challenge rather than throwing two challenges at it at the same time. This just makes sense to me. There are anecdotal stories that it's harder and people are more likely to have prolonged fatigue for several days after taking both shots together. That research is hard to get funded. The other bit of advice that I always give, besides separating them, is as soon as you get a Shingrix shot, the pharmacies will be calling you to come back in a month. Don't go. When you get that call from the pharmacy wanting to make you an appointment, tell them you want to make the appointment in 3 months after the shot. The shot will still work just as well, and you will avoid having a stronger and fiercer reaction to the next shot. And that can be, you know, fairly attenuating. People can end up, you know, spending 48 hours feeling like they're coming down with the flu with that second shot, and there's no need for that. It still works. They're just trying to capture market share. And, you know, that's great for them, but you don't have to go along with it. We already talked about the brain and music. Now we're going to talk about the brain in movies. So have you ever been watching a movie and wincing at the sight of someone slamming their fingers in a car door, or when we see people get injured? We have, whether we realize it or not at the time, a physical reaction, even though we're safe and in the comfort of our own home. And the reason behind these reactions has puzzled scientists for decades. But a new study published in Nature has found that our brain doesn't just process the information on the screen. It simulates what we see, making that sensation reverberate throughout our body. When you watch someone being tickled or getting hurt, the areas of the brain that process touch light up in patterns that match the body part involved. Your brain maps see into your own body, stimulating a touch sensation. Those parts of the brain light up even though you have not been touched. Vision and touch are much more closely linked than previously believed. So researchers were exploring this, and they analyzed brain activity of about 175 people while they were watching different movies. This analysis showed that our sense of touch is activated by what we see. When watching movies, the areas of our brain that process touch are activated in a highly specific way. Not only do the regions light up, but they act the same way they would as if we were being physically touched rather than watching touch on a screen. This connection is a type of sensory map that helps the brain process visual and sensory cues. And this is also going in the opposite direction. Our sense of touch activates certain visual areas of our brain, especially in low visibility conditions. When you navigate a bathroom in the dark, touch sensations help your visual system create an internal map of where things are, even with minimal visual input. And since I'm terrified, well, not terrified, but very aversive to any kind of blue or white light at night, because I feel it disturbs my ability to get back to sleep, I'm always using very dim light or no light at all to find my way to the bathroom. And I do believe that my sense of touch and my kind of mapping, if I get off track and I end up touching something I'm not expecting to touch, I can almost feel my visual map shift over with a sort of swerve to place me where I actually am. So there are two specific ways that the scientists have identified in which what we see can trigger the sensory brain map. And it works differently. In the higher regions of our visual system, the map aligns with what appears to be our field of view, like I just described to you in my bathroom voyage. The part of the brain that processes sensations in our feet corresponds to the lower areas in the visual field, while the part that processes facial sensations corresponds to the upper field. In the lower regions of our visual system, that is to say the more primitive places, the more where we're related to lizards and mammals in general, sensation is connected to what body part we are looking at. If you're looking at someone getting a needle stuck in their arm, that part of your arm will actually light up as if it was feeling that sensation in that location on your body. Now, this raises some interesting thoughts for autism. Sensory testing for neurodivergent individuals can be very overwhelming. But if the brain's responses to touch can be measured visually while watching a movie, medical professionals can replace stressful procedures with less invasive options and continue to learn and work towards better treatments for autism. So all very favorable there. just like the long COVID subtypes that we talked about, it's probably been close to a year now as we began to understand that there's a cardiac subtype, there's a immune subtype, there's a muscular subtype. Well, just as those subtypes evolved, as we see more and more cases and do more and more research on them, the closer we look and the longer we study anything, subtypes emerge that need different approaches. Recently, a team from Princeton and the Flatiron Institute released a paper showing evidence for four distinct autism phenotypes. A phenotype is a biological term for what something looks like on the outside, as opposed to what it looks like in their genetics. It's what is seen as on the surface, if you will. For decades, autism has been described as a spectrum, which is an elastic term that stretches all the way from adults with doctorates to nonverbal children. But beneath that spectrum, there's a shared pattern of social communication and behavioral differences. And now with advances in brain imaging, genetics, and computational science, we're seeing discrete biological subtypes. This may one day lead to more accurate diagnoses and treatments. And maybe we should think about whether autism should be seen as something to cure or as an essential facet of human diversity. There are a very few high-impact mutations that alone appear to lead to autism, but mostly that's a small minority of people who suffer from autism. The majority of cases arise from something similar, something subtler, common genetic variants that are in the population already, but when they combine in a certain way and there are certain additional environmental triggers present, they alter development. One such environmental trigger that we're aware of is the age of the father. The health or lack of health of the environment also seems to be a factor. Another bit of new information is that it all starts at birth. It turns out that some children may have genetic mutations when they're born that activate at different times in their life. So summing it all up, it is, as Natalie Sauerwald, one of the main researchers of this paper, says, there isn't just one autism. There are many autisms. Now, about 1 in 150 children were diagnosed with autism in 2000, according to the CDC. By 2022, that figure had climbed to 1 in 31. That looks like a huge increase, but many experts say it is not an epidemic of autism, but rather a greater understanding of its many form and a society that has become much more attuned to recognizing them. Now, Natalie Sauer is a computational biologist. She's sort of a numbers wonk, but in biological systems. She had been studying genes and their relationships to human health her entire life. She's previously published research on COVID-19 and cancer, but she had read a lot about how the significant variability of autism made it difficult to treat. So she went to the researchers at Princeton and began analyzing the autism database, which is managed by the Simons Foundation. This is a science nonprofit, and it has extensive information on over 5,000 children. The spectrum, she expected it would be very messy. The spectrum spans such a wide range. She thought the categories would blur together, like we said, our presumption that it's a spectrum. Instead, what she found with her analysis is that the data resolved into four groups with their own genetic and behavioral signatures. So this study was published in July of 2025 in Nature Genetics. Here are the four groups. Broadly affected, about 10% of individuals, they have the steepest challenges, developmental delays, problems with communications, repetitive behaviors that touch every part of their life. Mixed autism with developmental delay, about 19%. These show early development delays, but very few signs of anxiety, depression, or disruptive behavior. This is called the mixed because its members vary so widely in how strongly they display social or repetitive behaviors, two of the diagnostic hallmarks of autism. Moderate challenges, about a third of people fell into this group. They have the hallmark traits of autism, social and communication differences, repetitive habits, but subtler and most importantly, without developmental delays. Social and or behavioral, this is the largest group, 37%, met their early developmental milestones on time, but often grappled with other conditions later on, including ADHD, anxiety, depression, or obsessive compulsive disorder. The new analysis study showed that the delay may stem from mutations which are present when a child is born but activate later in life, as I said earlier. We've always thought of autism as a disorder, just a disorder of fetal development, but it may actually be the deck is stacked and it still needs some sort of environmental trigger to push it over. Now, a second study came in October of 25, different, published in Nature as well, but an entirely different team using separate data, and they came to the same conclusion. Genetically distinct forms of autism may unfold on different life timelines. And this suggested that children diagnosed after age 6 carry distinct genetic profiles, and their form of autism is strikingly different from the early childhood result, more of an emotional post-traumatic stress in terms of how it represents rather than the developmental delay. As I said, lots of genetic mutations have been linked to autism. Half appear to be inherited. The rest arise spontaneously. Let me say that again. The rest arise spontaneously from random copying errors in DNA or from outside influences. This is where the environment comes in. Air pollution, paternal age, maternal diabetes, prenatal infections, all of them may be enough to nudge people across the barrier, or they may just nudge them right up to the red line, but not over it. There are also other exposures that do not have strong statistical associations. Some of these include Tylenol, SSRI, and antidepressants, fever, and heavy metals. Other workers have looked at PFAs, those forever chemicals, and found no direct link between maternal PFAs and autism diagnoses. But the mother's PFA levels is correlated with the child's social developmental functioning. He thinks the chemicals may act on the developing brain, affecting hormone balance, and that would certainly fit with other people who are seeing these compounds as hormone receptors, fitting in other words, to the receptors and disrupting them. So the term hormone disruptor has come into popular parlance. I prefer hormone mimics because that just seems to me to be less politically inflammatory and more scientific. The other thing to realize is timing may prove decisive. Just like with thalidomide, women who took it early in the pregnancy, they took it to help with sleep. Early in pregnancy, it caused the limb defects. Later in pregnancy, but only between the 20th and the 24th day after conception, it was actually associated with increased risks of autism. Now, this is giving us early research into biochemical pathways in the brain. In some children, autoantibodies appear to block folate transport in the brain, hence the leucovorin, a form of vitamin B, to suggest it may restore function. These findings are very preliminary, but the medication is fast-tracked for approval for treatment of autism. The problem is it's not going to work for all autistics. 2 decades ago, scientists noted that some young children with autism had brains that grew unusually fast in infancy. I want to talk about the microglia, that immune system that controls your brain and also can be influential in the development of dementia. Well, if the microglia aren't active enough. During early brain development, you don't prune the synapses. And so part of the, some of the features of certain of the subtypes of autism seem as if they're getting too much sensory input, more than they can handle. And indeed, they may have more sensory connections than they should have, making it harder for them to focus and ignore stuff that ordinarily we learn to ignore in infancy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.